the managers of these funds and private wealth management groups, and you know, from Morgan Stanley to Bank of America to Goldman Sachs to Citi, they're all increasing their bold evaluations and predictions because they're seeing, one, all of these things happening. Two, therefore, their customers being like, well, should I be in gold now? And them saying, well, you know what? If our customers want to be in gold and we're trading gold and the world's going gold, well, we need to basically promote gold as well. So it becomes a self-fulfilling sort of activity in terms of buyers. All of these things are not going away.
All right. Good day. It's a good day for me because I have one of my heroes and favorite authors, Nomi Prinz. Nomi Prinz is the founder of Prinzsights Global, geopolitical economist, financial historian, author, journalist, keynote speaker, and mostly truth teller. I've been following you for a while, Nomi. It's great to have you.
Well, I so appreciate you and all that you're doing, and I'm looking forward to a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, Nova, we've got lots to talk about, lots going on in the world. But before that, just kind of how I discovered you, I found you through a book called Permanent Distortion that you've written years ago. You've been on Wall Street. You've been telling the truth about the way things really are financially. And I would like to know what your thoughts are on today. Where do you see the biggest distortion in the system right now?
Sure. And thank you for reading that. So I wrote Permanent Distortion during COVID, basically. It came out after COVID. And the idea behind it is simple. It's that the markets, the financial markets, are completely detached from the real economy and also what makes the real economy work. And that is generally hard assets, long-term assets, and strategic building. So as that has become permanently distorted, it has done so because there's been so much money flushed into the system, first after the financial crisis, then a whole lot more post-COVID. The Fed's book blew up, other asset buyers, central banks around the world pitched in, rates went down. But none of that really helped the real economy post-COVID or really now. So even if we see 3% or 2% growth in GDP quarterly figures here and there, we're not really seeing, particularly in the West, strategic development that's going to push the real economy forward. We see it a bit more in the East. And I'm making this like big geological and geographical blocks. But the point is that there is still a detachment and a distortion between how money gets created and where it goes and the longevity of that. And so right now, what I see is the biggest distortions are in just that. They're in the fact that we don't have enough supply and mining capacity to meet the demand of nuclear energy and how that's growing around the world. Their policies now, they're trying to keep up, but we've had a real gap. The distortion between how gold is becoming a monetary and a power and a geopolitical anchor around the world, and there's a gap there between where fiat is still being created and crafted, and we're talking about minor reductions in rates, I do too, relative to where real physical wealth and long-term growth and power really is. Same thing with silver, same thing with copper, same thing with lithium, which has gotten beaten up, but is still very much a presence, even though there's more above the ground right now. But we're looking at a real distortion between what is under the ground right now in terms of hard asset supply and hard commodity supply versus what is needed today and moving forward and what's demanded today and moving forward by superpowers, by wannabe superpowers, by different strategic alliances around the world.
Do you see gold as, gold's been on a tear. Do you see that, is it too late to jump in? Do you see that changing? And where do you see gold coming, going from here?
It's such a great question because every day multiple people ask me whether they're too late on buying gold. And the answer is no, you're not too late. Nobody is too late because the reason for gold's appreciation on a tear recently, but in general where it's going to go, is so multifaceted that it will continue to appreciate in price. And the mining, the supply for gold is going to lag that demand as more demand comes in. So, for example, there's four at least main reasons or main factors behind gold's current appreciation. One is, the relative weakness in the U.S. dollar, which has to do with the relative increase in U.S. debt and the fact that central banks around the world have for multiple years decided, led by China, but by Russia, by India, by Saudi Arabia, basically not to buy U.S. treasuries and instead to purchase gold into their reserves. And that's one of the reasons why we have had four record years of gold purchases by central banks, or in the fourth now. And we've also seen that the percentage of central bank reserves, money in their system to basically solidify their own financial systems, which is what those reserves do. And they also supply relationships and trade relationships between banks and financiers around the world. The percentage of gold is now second only to the U.S. dollar. So we have a situation where the dollar is depreciating. Gold has overstepped this summer the euro, which was the second most held reserve. And if we look at just that change, that's a massive change. That's basically saying that gold is outperforming effectively, not actually, the economy of Europe. And so these things are not going to change. And the other reason for gold purchasing by central banks, as opposed to purchasing new debt or new U.S. debt in particular, because so much of it is just to have a jurisdictional neutrality, to be able not to be under the perceived thumb of U.S. policy, whether that's government policy, whether that's monetary policy. And a lot of that growth and that sort of tear that we talk about started in the wake of the 2022 invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the sanctions that were put upon Russia in that scenario. Now, not talking about the war itself, what those sanctions did was it made Russia say, you know what, we need to have more liquidity, we need to more access to our assets. And China said that, and the rest of the BRICS said that, and Eastern European countries said that. And they basically said, look, if there can be a sanction at any point in time against the liquidity of a nation, well, then we need to have something physical that we can move and use and value and accrete that is not going to be subject to that. And that was the other reason that gold has been pushed up. Now, we throw into that what's happened in the nations themselves. For example, in China, there's been a purchasing of gold by the central bank. There has been a purchasing of gold by the state-owned banks, which connect into the central bank. There's been a purchasing of gold by the citizens of the country through their banks, through the up to the central bank. So there's been this whole sort of cascade of gold buying. In the West, until very recently, there's been an underperformance, for example, in gold-backed ETFs, exchange-traded funds that buy gold to physically have that anchor relative to their funds and their fund management, which just in this first half of the year, for the first time, the West has outperformed the East in terms of buying sort of exchange-traded or funded gold vehicles. And that's kicked into the current tear in the last few months. That's basically been accelerating because people are saying, look, whether we're too late or not, this train is still moving and we would like to jump on. And the fourth thing is that the managers of these funds and private wealth management groups, and you know, from Morgan Stanley to Bank of America to Goldman Sachs to Citi, they're all increasing their gold evaluations and predictions because they're seeing, one, all of these things happening. Two, therefore, their customers being like, well, should I be in gold now? And them saying, well, you know what? If our customers want to be in gold and we're trading gold and the world's going gold, well, we need to basically promote gold as well. So it becomes a self-fulfilling sort of activity in terms of buyers. All of these things are not going away. So in terms of gold buying and the level that gold's at, you know, we're almost at 4,000. We predicted it would be at 4,000 by the end of the year in January. Now we're saying 4,500 by the turn of the year. It's because none of these factors have any reason to stop, but only reasons to grow.
Yeah, we've got a huge debt problem. Yep. And I don't know what the way out of that is. I don't know what the end, what's behind this or what's at the end of the tunnel. But I mean, is there any room for optimism? I mean, where are things going in terms of protecting ourselves from the financial chaos that's going on? Like, how can investors protect themselves? And is there reason for optimism?
Well, from the standpoint of debt that you mentioned, the U.S. with over $37 trillion of debt, the global debt right now is at $338 trillion, which is a stupidly astronomical amount. But the point is it keeps growing And the momentum and the sort of pace that it's growing is accelerating. So what's happening is there isn't a sort of global move towards using that debt in a way that facilitates growth. This is the permanent distortion that I spoke about in the book, Permanent Distortion, that continues. Since the book came out, our debt has increased. Global debt has increased. The pace of economic growth versus debt growth has declined. And so what's the positive in this? Well, the positive in this is there are still projects being greenlighted. There is still an assessment of the need. For example, if we talk about uranium as one, you know, physical asset, one of the things that the government, the U.S. government has started to do is put in policies that fast track the production or the enrichment of uranium to be used in nuclear energy. And there's more agreements. There's just an agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. on making this move faster and so forth. So there are these pockets of knowledge or acknowledgement where there is a need to grow energy, to grow infrastructure, and there are certain assets that require more attention, policy attention, to make that happen. And with that comes, you know, engineering jobs, geologist jobs, scientist jobs, physical construction jobs. And so there's a way to see us turning from this diversion between debt and growth, but it's going to take time. And so in the meantime, what can an investor do? Well, investors should, and this is where we're focused every day, is focus on buying physical assets and on buying the miners. And you could look at the larger ones that are, you know, also more positioned, handing out dividends and sort of more established, or the junior miners that are in particular areas where there is a close time gap between what they're mining and when it will actually come out of the ground, and invest in those. So what that means is moving your portfolio from bonds definitely into hard assets. The question of equities is somewhat different because equities cover production, they cover infrastructure, they cover miners. And it's very important to be specific in what you choose on the equity thing. But I don't see a reason to own bonds. I never really have. We've never recommended bondholders. But when we look at the standard portfolio, that 40-60 bond to equity or sort of somewhere in between allocation, that's just outdated relative to the need for commodities, the lack of supply, and the growth in these areas. And so the best thing I think investors can do is reallocate at the very least, 10%, 15% of whatever they have in bonds into a portfolio of commodities and or miners, depending on, you know, the risk tolerance. They can do it in ETFs. They can do it in physical. There's so many platforms nowadays where you can purchase physical silver or gold or platinum or palladium and know that it's securely stored somewhere, you know, not in a box under your house, but still secure. And ways to do that. And I think that's the best thing an investor looking at the next 3 months, the next 6 months, the next 3 years, the next 6 years, their families can really position themselves and protect themselves and grow that financial stability.
So Nomi, you talked about the shortage of uranium. If you can tell us, like, where are we with that in terms of, are we looking at the golden age of nuclear? And if so, if that happens, what happens to other energy sectors and the energy market as a whole?
Yeah, so nuclear energy, for example, in the U.S., powers about 20% of the electricity in the U.S. It's a bit less in Europe, and it's a bit less in China. It's a bit less in India and so forth. However, it's definitely a very fast-growing component of the energy sector. And the reason for that is because it's got a neutrality to it in terms of carbon footprint, in terms of green energy, whether you are pro-green, not pro-green, whatever. It still is a more efficient, more economic, cleaner, and more dependable way of producing energy. Relative to other renewables, it has a sort of place in between fossil fuels and more renewable energies, from hydrogen to solar to wind, because you can turn it on and off in a nanosecond. You don't have to accumulate it if it's there. You can just turn on a switch and move to nuclear power. And basically that will have more of a sustainable way of producing electricity. And so for that reason, And also the fact that it's used in the military, but it's used for individuals and in retail and businesses as well, and by AI data centers, which are growing, and that's why they're investing in uranium and investing in technologies that can bring nuclear power closer to need. So not necessarily a big nuclear plant somewhere on the outskirts of some small town, but in things called small modular reactors or micro modular reactors, or ways to basically take the uranium, enriched uranium, into a mechanism that produces nuclear power to be used in a grid close to the end user. All of this is being developed more and more quickly, and being brought more and more to scale. So the relationship and the most recent agreement, for example, between the US and the UK a few weeks ago was about technology. It was about, with all the words that was in the agreement, it was about the recognition that AI data means of really pulling on existing grids need to be supplemented, and nuclear is a way to do it. And here are the agreements we have. And in the wake of that deal, a bunch of power plants and a bunch of technological permits that were needed all basically moved into advanced stages. And so it did light a fire under. So what does that all mean? It means that the nuclear power space is definitely growing. It requires uranium right now. Most of the uranium comes from Russia or Kazakhstan or basically Eastern Europe. So there is a desire from a geopolitical standpoint, from an energy independence standpoint, to find sources and develop sources away from that area, simply to maintain sort of control over nuclear output. The U.S., for example, still has sanctions against Russia, but still uses its uranium or a portion of its enriched uranium. And so there are these things that are going on the world on the sort of outside, and then what's actually happening on the inside. And with nuclear power and uranium, particularly, the story on the inside is very different from the positioning on the outside. And all of that means you should be invested in uranium and mines.
So how do you feel about copper? Where's that going?
It's similar with copper, except that copper is more dispersed throughout the world already. So you do have more mines across South America, across Central America, in the East. You basically have a bit of a more spread in Canada and so forth. And so you have more of a sort of geopolitical neutrality around copper at the moment than around uranium. Although the U.S. just put copper on its critical minerals list a couple months ago for the first time. So it has recognized that it needs to, as a major superpower in the world that it is at the moment, stockpile or access more copper projects. Now, the reason, though, that I think copper prices haven't had the same tear this year anyway that they did, and then they came back down because of issues of economic slowdowns, and this idea that if the economy slowed down around the world, copper is not going to be as needed or not needed as quickly. There's enough supply already, etc. So prices dampened a bit, but they've been creeping up. But I think they're going to see a much more acceleration into next year. I would have thought it would have happened this year, but again, you've got the headwind of the economic story. But you can't build grids, you can't supply energy, you can't use uranium, you can't use electricity, you can't upgrade what you already have without copper. It is the baseline of electricity. It's the baseline of a lot of plumbing and water, and it does have that conductivity and that protective aspect to it. So I do think we're going to see more in copper, but just because it's all over the place already and the supply demand isn't quite as out of whack yet, but it is becoming so. And that headwind of the economic story, I think this is actually a good time to invest and wait in copper. We have a few copper names in our portfolio. They're not doing as well as gold and silver and uranium and some of the other commodities because of the reason we're talking about. But I think it's definitely like that sleeping giant where once there is more stockpiling of copper, and for example, China has started to do this, and once there is more infrastructure building, despite whatever's happening with economic data, it's going to take copper up to the next level.
Would you say copper is one of the more underappreciated, undervalued? And then nickel as well? I mean, where do you stand with nickel?
Nickel, same thing. It's had some of the same issues that copper has had, which is there are smaller mines. They are around the world, and it's kind of the second cousin to copper in terms of its need in infrastructure building and in energy related grid and other types of building. So, and it's more expensive to mine. And so there has been also a bit of a sort of headwind as well for that extra reason with nickel. But also, I think that should be in a portfolio. And I think it's really a matter of time before these infrastructure strategies, which do exist around the world, have to be put into place. And this idea that economies are slowing down will not be enough to keep the necessity and the supply necessity for copper, for nickel, for lithium, too, has been another one that's really been beaten down because of the idea that, oh, EVs are over, or you know, we have all the lithium we need. Lithium's plentiful all over the world, and all these sort of things that are said about lithium. I think that's another commodity that has yet to jump up again and also needs to be a part of a portfolio. I wouldn't necessarily invest in as much nickel or lithium as I would in copper, and then as I would in silver and gold and uranium and platinum and palladium for also scarcity reasons. But again, these are all part of a healthy commodity portfolio.
You see silver as more of money, or do you see it more as a industrial metal? And with that, do you see silver typically following gold again in terms of the, it just seems to follow gold and then outpace gold. Is that kind of what investors can expect this time as well?
Yeah, I absolutely do think that. For all the reasons we talked about before, gold's definitely going to continue to move upward. And silver has outpaced gold this year. It doesn't have the same central bank cachet. And that's one of the reasons why it's not, I think, talked about as much. You can't point to, well, here's this big industrial project that uses silver. So silver is going to go up, because silver is a part of almost every industrial project. And again, when you put the headwind of the wealth economy slow down, silver use, and that has been around, but it hasn't really impacted silver to the extent it's impacted copper, because silver takes longer to get to ground. And because there are still a lot of mines, a lot of silver underground relative to what the demand is to supply. So we are at a 2-year supply deficit for silver going into the third year. So at today's demand, that's not talking about new jewelry demand or new wealth preservation demand or new safe haven demand or new, it still needs to catch up to gold and outperform even more so relative to gold demand or central bank demand. We still see it moving, and we still have a supply deficit. And there are not enough. We're actually just writing this piece for a recommendation we actually will have in silver next week out to our premium investors. There is not enough silver even in the new permit stage, or the permit stage just about to be in production, to fulfill the current demand versus supply gap. So even with the mine world that are closest to production, we're actively looking at recommending one of them because it's close to production, there is still not enough that's going to come online fast enough to meet current demand. And that's if demand doesn't grow. So I think we're going to see another spike up in silver ahead for that reason. And I'm talking about actually until 2027. We don't have enough coming online. So it's about a year and a half almost to even meet current demand.
So when it comes to commodities, we're talking super cycle still. We're talking upswing. Buy and hold makes a lot of sense. For do you still see a lot of volatility in these sectors? And is that the way to think about it? And just the long-term buy and hold, or how can we prepare?
I am so glad you asked that. I'm very much a buy and hold gal, because especially in, as you say, we are in a super cycle. There are so many reasons that are contributing to the upside in different time periods of all of these commodities and in different ways, that actually buying and holding is, unless you need the cash or you need the capital for some other reason, and then you'll look at your portfolio and you decide what to sell and what's appreciated the most and where you want to take liquidity. But I think we are in a definite cycle where buy and hold is the best strategy. And I often get investors who'll say, oh, you know, you had this recommendation, went up by so much, how come you're still holding it? It's like, because it's still going to go up further. There's no particular reason, unless you individually want to sell it for your own purposes, which everyone should make their own decision on, do their own homework. I don't see a reason to sell. And my own portfolio is like that as well. I have moved a lot of a percentage of my assets into commodities over the years. And I don't feel the need to, including in long-term investment vehicles, and I do not feel the need to sell them. Where you do sell a commodity or a miner is when something dramatically happens to that miner, to that jurisdiction, to that balance sheet. You know, there's something that's very specific. But if we're looking at the commodities themselves and mining companies that are well permitted, that are in good jurisdictions, that have high quality assets, they're all those. You know, they meet those parameters. They're all by and large buy and hold positions.
For listeners who want to learn more about you or follow kind of your insights, can you tell us a little bit more about how we can do that?
Sure. So I have a Substack, which is the best way to follow me regularly, which is princesites.substack.com. We do have two different portfolio products for smaller cap and medium and larger cap oriented investors, as well as a lot of complementary material on the various trends that we see happening all the time. I'm constantly focused on, you know, what's going on next, as well as what's going on now. And so that's really a very dynamic place to be. And I am working on a new book. I can't give it away, but because we're still working on titles and such. But at that point, maybe we'll come back and talk about that.
Nomi, great to have you. Again, I'm a huge fan of Nomi Prince. It's an honor to have you. So thank you for this time and sharing your knowledge and for helping investors protect ourselves from the chaos. So thank you.
Thank you.